Welcome to Ordain and Establish, a podcast of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition at Catholic University. To learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.
Welcome to the fourth annual lecture in Catholic Political Thought. I'm Joel Elisea. I'm a law professor here at Catholic University and the director of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition, one of the co-sponsors of this event. The annual lecture in Catholic Political Thought is the signature event of Catholic University's program in Catholic Political Thought. The program draws on resources across the university to provide doctoral students with the means to acquire a comprehensive knowledge of the tradition of Catholic political thought. This program is housed in the Institute for Human Ecology, the primary sponsor of this lecture. The program is guided by co-directors Russell Hittinger, who's the executive director of IHE, Brad Lewis, the Dean of the School of Philosophy, and Joe Capizzi, Dean of the School of Theology and Religious Studies. This year's lecture, Resurrecting Justice, How Christianity Gives Justice More Than Its Due, will be delivered by Daniel Philpott, Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. We're very honored to have Professor Philpott deliver this lecture this year. I now invite President Kilpatrick to the stage to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Joel. Very excited to introduce our guest speaker tonight. A little bit about Dan. It's probably unnecessary for many of you who know Dan Philpott. Dan is a professor of political science at Notre Dame and earned his PhD in 96 from Harvard University, and he specializes in religion and global politics, particularly focusing on religious freedom, reconciliation, restorative justice, the political behavior of religious actors, and Christian political theology. Dan has a number of books, including Revolutions and Sovereignty by Princeton, 2001, God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics, Norton, co-authored with some co-authors, Just and Unjust Peace, An Ethic of Political Reconciliation, Oxford, 2012, and Religious Freedom in Islam, The Fate of a Universal Human Right in the Muslim World, also by Oxford, 2019. Currently, he's writing a book, I believe on the topic of his lecture tonight, that sets forth a political theology based on a Christian concept of justice. Dan has promoted reconciliation as an activist in Kashmir, the Great Lakes region of Africa, and within the American Catholic Church with respect to clerical sex abuse. He's a lay Dominican. I have a little story to tell about Dan. I've known Dan now, I believe, for 17 years since I first came to Catholic University. And when I first arrived at Notre Dame, when I first arrived at Notre Dame, we were building a new engineering building. And I was very insistent that there be a chapel in the new engineering building because, you know, Notre Dame's famous for its proliferation of chapels, and I wanted it to be the prettiest chapel on campus. So I collaborated with then the rector of the Basilica, Peter Rocca, Father Peter Rocca, and we built, I think, a very nice chapel, and we dedicated it to the Congregation of Holy Cross. Dan was one of the first attendees at our daily mass. I was the sacristan, and so we kind of kept the chapel going and really built it up to the point where I think we were pretty much filling the chapel up every day. It held about 50 people. And the mass goes on, and Dan is now the sacristan. So I owe Dan a big debt of gratitude for keeping that worshiping community going. Dan's just delightful person, if you don't know him well. The way I like to characterize him is he's one of the most pure-hearted people I've ever met. So it's just a great joy for me to welcome Dan to the Catholic University of America and for Dan to deliver this important lecture. Please join me in welcoming Dan.
Well, thank you, President Kilpatrick, for the kind introduction, and Professor Elisea for introducing the event. And Professor Kilpatrick is remembered fondly at Notre Dame, and even today there is standing room only attendance in the chapel at the engineering school, no doing of mine. And what an honor it is to present the fourth annual lecture on Catholic political thought. I was present at the first lecture, a brilliant one delivered by Russell Hittinger, and still have it etched vividly in my memory. Thank you, Russ and Brad Lewis and Joe Capizzi, for your dedication to this event and for your kind invitation. Professor Tardavel Schick for attending, who was the lecturer last year, and to the Institute for Human Ecology and the Center for the Constitution in the Catholic Intellectual Tradition for your sponsorship. For some years, I have followed societies in their efforts to address past evil, those of countries such as South Africa, Chile, Uganda, and Germany, and of the Catholic Church towards its clerical abuse. I have discerned two paradigms. The dominant paradigm held by diplomats, politicians, human rights activists, and international lawyers centers on restoring rights and the rule of law and dreams most fervently of trials and punishment for arch offenders. But I heard a different language in the voice of religious leaders who spoke of reconciliation, forgiveness, reparation, and the healing of wounds. I have come to think that the two paradigms were at bottom two ways of thinking about justice. This will surprise Westerners who think of justice as rights and law and of the message of the religious leaders as something that might be good, but is something other than justice. I have become convinced, though, that the religious leaders had a different way of thinking about justice, and that they drew it from their most important source, the Bible. The Apostle Paul describes God's reconciliation through the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ as justice, at least in some translations. And this pivotal event in salvation history was nobody's right, but rather God's gracious gift, as Paul wrote, and deigns to restore the world. The justice of reconciliation was the axial idea of religious leaders in South Africa, Germany, and so many other places. So, I sought to develop this concept of justice in my book of 2012, Just and Unjust Peace, arguing that this justice could enfold rights in the rule of law, but also involve restorative measures such as public apology, the telling of the truth about injustices, and forgiveness. Now, I seek to develop this concept of justice further and expand it to all of politics, not only to confronting the past, and believe that it holds promise for divided and wounded political orders, including, as I shall explain, the United States. The eminent philosopher John Rawls wrote that justice is the first virtue of social institutions, an apothegm that philosophers reaching back to Plato as easily could have voiced. And what is justice? Over the course of many centuries, the concept of justice that has attained the world's widest endorsement is the will to render each person his due. The concept originated in Greek and Roman thought, was formulated most fully and enduringly by the Roman jurist Ulpian in the 3rd century, and is recognizable far more widely in due's synonymous guise, rights. Rights have an elephantine presence in Western political thought and political discourse, in constitutions, which all but 6 states in the world possess, and in international law. This concept of justice as rendering due or fulfilling rights is so pervasive and enveloping that seeing justice differently requires climbing to an overlook where one can take in a wider landscape. What we can see from there is that the justice streaming from the Greek and Roman traditions has overswept the justice that streams through and from another source, the Bible. And what is the meaning of this justice? Nowhere does the Bible teach that justice means the will to render another her due. Justice in the Bible is rather, I argue, the totality of actions that bring about comprehensive right relationship between God and humanity, between human beings, and within the human soul. These actions are governed by principles, some of which indeed call for rendering others their due, that is, fulfilling their rights, a concept that Christian justice does not omit. But do is not enough. Other principles in the Bible prescribe actions that exceed what is due to others, including mercy, generosity, care, gift, hospitality, forgiveness, peacemaking, loving one's enemies, and reconciliation. Christian justice entails both kinds of principles, those that render what is due and those that exceed due, which together make up the entire set of commands that God enjoins upon humans. If it grates in our ears to call all of these principles justice, is it not at all strange that modern Christians have adopted so readily the justice of Athens and Rome and not that of Jerusalem? Let us look more closely at the Bible. What is the case that its justice means comprehensive right relationship? Two terms in the scripture are the best candidates for being translated to justice. In the Old Testament, the term is the Hebrew tzedek, or its feminine variant tzedakah, which appears 276 times. The authors of the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Bible of the 3rd century BCE, widely used the term dikaiosune to translate tzedek, a term that then appears 92 times in the New Testament and that carries forth the meaning of tzedek. While all of these usages carry a bewildering variety of specific meanings, they also all share an overarching meaning, comprehensive right relationship. One of the most interesting variations in their meaning is agency. Sometimes tzedek and dikaiosune refer to the actions that God carries out. Other times, they refer to the actions that God prescribes for humans to perform. God carries out tzedek and dikaiosune in creating and sustaining the moral order of the universe, an establishment of right relationship, and in redeeming it and ultimately bringing it to completion, the restoration of right relationship. Divinely enacted tzedek is most concentrated in Psalms, Proverbs, Isaiah, and Ezekiel. Tzedek expresses God's restoration of Israel in 2 Isaiah, whose mysterious and messianic agent is the servant whom the Lord has called for the victory of tzedek. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus identifies himself with the servant who brings about this victory by quoting Isaiah 42. This victory is the restoration of right relationship that Jesus achieves in the cross and resurrection. Dikaiosune theou is the term that the Apostle Paul describes to describe this divine restoration and that he makes the central theme of his letter to the Romans. The culmination of this restoration is the new heavens and new earth that the Apostle Peter describes as dikaiosune. Humans enact tzedek and dikaiosune when they act according to God's commands. Our tzedek before the Lord, our God, is to consist in carefully observing all these commandments he has enjoined on us, the book of Deuteronomy reads, continuing somewhat later, tzedek and tzedek alone shall be your aim. Dikaiosune means the entirety of God's commandments in the New Testament, where it is most concentrated in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount that those who hunger and thirst for dikaiosune are blessed, that one's dikaiosune ought to surpass that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, and that one ought to seek first the kingdom of God and his dikaiosune, and that one ought not to practice dikaiosune in order to be seen. Commandments, in turn, are central to the morality of both the Old and New Testaments. Repeated in the Old Testament is God's decree to keep his commandments, statutes, ordinances, laws. Psalm 19 indeed contains 9 different words for principles. Aquinas categorizes the Old Testament commands as moral precepts, which are the 10 commandments, and as the many judicial and ceremonial precepts which are derived from them. Jesus fulfills the law in a way that upholds the injunctive force of the 10 commandments, but not that of the judicial and ceremonial precepts, and adds some other commands, such as be merciful, take up one's cross, and follow him, be a peacemaker, and forgive. All of the law, all of which protects or promotes right relationship, makes up tzedek and dikaiosune. Are tzedek and dikaiosune, then, the Bible's justice? This may seem strange. The reason that it seems strange is that in English Bibles, these words are often translated into righteousness as well as justice. The problem with both English words, righteousness and justice, though, is that neither captures the wide meaning of tzedek and dikaiosune. Righteousness in today's English connotes personal probity and even priggishness, and fails to capture aspects of right behavior such as fairness in economic dealings or laws against extortion. For its part, justice, connoting what is due, has a public and juridical meaning and fails to capture, say, principles of mercy and compassion. Summoning either word to translate tzedek and dikaiosune, then, demands that modern English speakers expand their notion of this word's meaning if they are to be faithful to the Bible's meaning. I propose justice. I opt thus because I hope that my fellow readers of the Bible, and citizens at that, would come to think of justice as the wide meaning of tzedek and dikaiosune. The proposal is not merely notional. It is the choice of the Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible that stood as the most important Bible in the church for 1,000 years. The Vulgate translates the many instances of tzedek and dikaiosune as justitia, or a close cognate, the term that readily translates to justice in English. Similarly, in languages such as languages based in Latin, such as French, Spanish, and Italian, the terms are translated almost uniformly as justis, justitia, and justitia, and their variants. The Douay-Rheims Bible, the English language Bible that is translated directly from the Vulgate, also adopts justice terms. So, seek first the kingdom of God and his justice, and you will be seeking a justice that contains the wide meaning of tzedek and dikaiosune, all of the ways that God is calling you to trod. If the justice of the Bible means comprehensive right relationship, this same justice blends two kinds of principles, those that render and those that exceed what is due, and so contrasts with the classical justice that only renders due. This blend shapes both divine and human justice in the Bible. Consider, for instance, God's justice in creating and sustaining the world and its moral order. These actions are gifts, not something that is humanity's due. Yet there is also a sense in which the justice of God's actions renders due. While it may seem irreverent to say that God owes humanity anything, God indeed made promises to humanity in the form of covenants, and promises, by definition, are commitments to make good on what is promised. As St. Anselm wrote, God, quote, put himself under an obligation to humanity, unquote, doing so out of his free and sovereign will on the basis of his commitment to his creation. God makes good on his promises by redeeming the world, a justice that also blends what is due and what exceeds due. Bible scholar Gary Anderson makes the case that by the time of the Babylonian exile, the Bible had adopted debt as its primary metaphor for the condition that sin creates. Debt expresses the natural law principle of retribution. When a person sins, he now stands indebted to God and to any victims. He owes them actions that pay this debt and negate the standing victory of the sin, and they have a right to these actions. In several passages in the Pentateuch, God promises to reward people who keep his commandments, that is, who do justice, and to punish people who break them. You render to each of us according to our deeds, Psalm 62:12 puts it. Exile is Israel's payment of the debt it has accrued for centuries of idolatry, pride, corruption, and mistreatment of the poor under its kings. The word redemption, occurring 22 times in Isaiah, more than in any other book, describes God's eventual release of Israel from debt slavery, the condition that an entrapped debtor incurs. recompense, expiation, service, debt. All of these words in 2 Isaiah imply a payment that Israel has rendered, a debt that it has paid. Yet, due does not tame, limit, or exhaust God's rectifying justice in the Old Testament. 2 Isaiah, replete with tzedek, or saving justice, reports superabundance. Quote, Israel has received from the hand of the Lord double for all her sins, unquote. Over the next 8 or so chapters, Isaiah reports that redemption involves more yet, an actual restoration that exceeds all payment. It recounts the return of the Israelites to Judah and the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple in terms of lush nature, prosperity, peace, justice, triumph over enemies, and the uplift of the poor and the dispossessed. This is a justice of comprehensive restoration, a healing of the wounds of sin, not only a payment of its debt, but also a cleansing of the stain and the burden that mar right relationship between people and God, among people, and within people. It is a justice realized in part through the Israelites' return, but also prophesied in 3 Isaiah as a messianic restoration, where God will, quote, make justice and praise spring up before all the nations, unquote. The justice of restoration reaches a climax in the New Testament, where it again melds due and beyond due. Debt remains a metaphor for sin, most pronouncedly in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. The payment of debt for sin is prominent among the New Testament's metaphors for the salvation won by Jesus' cross and resurrection, along with other metaphors that connote due: ransom, price, expiation, acquittal, and redemption. Yet, again, the restoration of right relationship or justice that the cross and resurrection accomplish are far wider and fuller than the debt of rendering justice of rendering due. First, Jesus' payment of the debt of sin is a gift, as Paul teaches in his letter to the Romans, a payment that he made on behalf of the ones who owed the debt, and one that he made, quote, while we were still sinners, not upon humanity having first repented or settled accounts. God forgave on his initiative out of love. Second, Christ pays the debt superabundantly, as Aquinas notes, as does God in Isaiah. Third, again paralleling Isaiah, God does not only free humanity from the debt of sin, but also wins the grace that provides for the total healing of the wounds of sin and restoration of right relationship. The twofold movement of freedom from sin and restoration is the Bible's justification and reconciliation, which are one with God's justice. Reflecting divine justice, the human justice of right relationship combines what is due and what is more than due. It includes obligations that fulfill rights, so prominent in modern political thought and in law around the world, and differs from the skepticism of rights voiced by Christian intellectuals, including Oliver O'Donovan, Joan Lockwood O'Donovan, John Milbank, Alistair MacIntyre, Michel Vili, Ernest Fortin, Nigel Bigger, Simone Weil, Richard Hayes, and Stanley Hauerwas, who look upon rights, all in one way or another, as possessive, individualistic, and vehicles of self-assertion. Rights find sound defense, though, as protections of human dignity. Rights are found explicitly in the Bible, for instance, the rights of the poor in Proverbs 9:29-7. They are found more extensively in the natural law, which reason can apprehend, and which the Catholic and certain Protestant traditions find in the Ten Commandments and their corollaries. The actions that these obligations prescribe or prohibit not only engender the virtue of their performers, but also are demanded by the dignity of their recipients. The duty not to lie corresponds to a right not to be lied to, the duty not to murder, to the right to life, and so on. Dignity or human worth arises from the image of God in persons declared in Genesis. Particular basic or intrinsically valuable human goods, such as life, health, and knowledge, manifest this dignity and serve to ground particular rights to life against torture and to freedom of speech, for instance. rights, grounded in the dignity of bearers of the divine image, have a long place in the Christian tradition. Pope John XXIII espoused natural or human rights in Pacem in Terris in 1963, lauding the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, which roots human rights in dignity in its preamble. Pope John Paul II endorsed the same ideas, making human rights, grounded in dignity, central to his confrontation with communism in the 1980s. Natural rights extend back to Pope Leo XIII, to several Protestant reformers, to the Spanish scholastics of the 16th century and their defense of native peoples in the New World, to medieval canon law, arguably to the thought of Thomas Aquinas, and to early church fathers such as Lactantius and Tertullian, as my colleague and friend Tim Shaw has demonstrated. Obligations that fulfill rights and thus are due to others belong to the justice of right relationship. Other obligations in the Bible, ones that God commands, do not correspond to the rights of others. They are not due, but rather open-ended, subject to discretion in how and to whom they are directed. Let us say that Teresa believes that she has an obligation to serve the poor. Possessing finite time and resources, she must choose: volunteer at the homeless shelter, give to an overseas humanitarian agency, or tutor at a local school. She cannot do all of these things, and none of them strictly obligates her. A poor person across town or in Nairobi may not claim a right to her resources. Teresa has a duty to care for the poor, but it is open-ended. It is what philosophers call an imperfect duty. The Bible contains many imperfect duties: to be merciful, practice generosity, live as a gift, take up one's cross, make peace, form friendships, care for the poor, practice hospitality, and love one's enemies. The combination of do and more than do also makes up the principles of human justice that address past wrongs. The justice of punishment, war, apologies, reparations, reconciliation, and forgiveness. Do is the idea of retribution. A person who commits a wrong breaks right relationship with the person wronged, and his wrong stands as a wound. The wrongdoer incurs a debt. He deserves to make good on the wrong, and the wronged have a right to proportionate retaliation. If the wrong is a crime, its victims include fellow citizens who live under the law, which defines right relationship in the political order, and the government represents them in pursuing just punishment, which involves deprivation. Retribution is axiomatic. It is the self-evident connection between deed, guilt, and consequences. It is affirmed widely across time and place and underpins divine action and human institutions in both Old and New Testaments. Modern theories of crime, the utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham and Cesare Beccaria, omit this justice and court further injustices. At the other pole, Kant insisted on retribution apart from any good that it brings. Punishment's purpose in the Bible is to restore right relationship in God's creation, including among communities, a principle rooted in the good. Punishment belongs to justice. Yet if justice towards past wrongs honors due, it is not confined to due. The wronged have a right to punishment, but may justifiably forego it, just as a creditor may cancel a debt without committing a wrong. In the political sphere, law enforcement agencies are forced by scarcity to choose which crimes to investigate and which to pass over. Admissible sometimes are presidential pardons or amnesties for rebels and dictators in order to secure a peace agreement or transition to democracy. Restorative justice, which has arisen in criminal justice in recent years in the West, does not forego deserved punishment, but advocates forms of it that address the wide range of wounds that crimes inflict on persons and relationships, and that include wide participation. Reflecting Old Testament Israel's codes of restitution and the holistic restoration initiated by the cross and resurrection, restorative justice has been advocated by Mennonite theologians and taken up by the U.S. Catholic bishops. It resonates with rituals for reintegrating wrongdoers found in indigenous traditions, such as those of Maoris in New Zealand and Acholis in Uganda. The Bible's most dramatic departure from retribution is Jesus' teaching of forgiveness. Forgive others their debts. This is a commandment and thus a matter of justice, but not justice as usual. Jesus teaches his hearers on a hillside to forgo what their wrongdoers owe them on account of their wrong. He does not repudiate the lex talionis of the Torah, an eye for an eye, which affirms the retributive principle as well as its proper proportionality, but rather develops it, commanding his hearers not merely to limit retribution, but rather to forgo it altogether. Forgiveness also involves a will towards the restoration of the wrongdoer. Why does Jesus teach that we ought to forgive? Because God forgives our debt of sin and did so definitively through Jesus' death on the cross and his resurrection. Nowhere is this logic clearer than in Jesus' parable of the unforgiving servant in the Gospel of Matthew, the servant who refused to forgive his debtor, though he had been forgiven, and who thus incurs debtor's prison. Does Jesus' teaching of forgiveness annul judicial punishment? No, because the state and other organizations are bound to uphold laws and norms, the contours of right relationship. Jesus was not speaking to his hearers in their capacity as magistrates or other heads. In other respects, though, forgiveness may bear on crimes or other political matters. Pope John Paul II forgave his assassin in prison in 1983, even while he did not call into question the principle of prison. A survey I conducted in Uganda found that 68% of victims of political violence claimed to have forgiven their perpetrators. What I've been arguing for so far, to summarize, is the justice of right relationship, which consists of actions governed by principles that render others what is their due or their right, as well as actions that exceed what is due. This justice is found in the Bible and consists of the natural law known by reason and mirroring God, and of supernatural principles that specify the natural law further and are known by the teachings of Jesus. Each sort of principle is important for moral and political life. The principles that fulfill rights secure dimensions of human dignity by prescribing specific and dischargeable actions. Do not torture, provide everyone safe working conditions, respect everyone's practice of religion. The beyond due principles mostly involve the healing of wounds. The chief of these principles is mercy, which calls for alleviating distress. Mercy animates the principle of reconciliation, the comprehensive restoration of right relationship, the justice that restores. I propose that this wider justice holds promise for democratic political orders, including our own. The political order is a subset of the justice of right relationship. It bears on matters subject to public law and political authority, whose purpose is to coordinate and enforce aspects of this justice. If justice means right relationship and consists of both kinds of principles, due and beyond due, then a Christian ought to work to realize this justice in the political order. Scholars have shown in recent works that political thought and discourse since the Enlightenment has sidelined beyond due principles, such as mercy, hospitality, care, and forgiveness, and have called for their revival in politics. True, governments sometimes pursue beyond due principles, say through humanitarian relief or health care. Still, if justice is predominantly thought to be the will to render due, and if justice is the first virtue of institutions, then beyond due principles will come to be viewed as marginal and optional in political discourse and action. To be sure, the justice of right relationship is to be realized through constitutional liberal democracy and its limits on government. Human rights include religious freedom, including religious freedom, equal citizenship, the rule of law, the rights of associations, the independence of church and state and their authority, economic freedom, subsidiarity, and prudence. These principles themselves are rooted in natural law and a Christian concept of the person, one that features freedom. Here lies a Christian liberalism. None of these limits prevents the practice of mercy and hospitality, care and forgiveness. These principles find all the more opportunity in the fact that politics is more than making and enforcing laws. The justice of right relationship also finds application in the prototypical liberal republic, the United States. It has been practiced in response to this country's most colossal injustices, and may still be practiced in response to them and to the historical wounds that they leave. In the matter of race, which has been called America's original sin, historical injustices fall into three episodes. The first is slavery, chattel racialized slavery, which was practiced legally from 1619 through 1865 and involved an estimated 100 million slaves and 10 billion hours of labor. The second is the period of Jim Crow, spanning from around 1877 through the mid-1960s. Laws, policies, and government action in 17 states practiced numerous forms of harsh discrimination and obstruction of economic development, and failed to enforce against the 4,000 lynchings that backed up the social system between 1877 and 1950. The third is less well known and might be called distributive discrimination, consisting of vast transfers of wealth through the New Deal and the Fair Deal from the 1940s through the 1960s, and housing policies from the 1930s to the 1960s that largely and intentionally excluded African Americans and thus sustained and widened racial disparities in wealth, education, homeownership, and opportunities for economic advancement. American prophets against these injustices have given central place to natural rights, ones that they have understood to be embedded in natural law, established by God, and articulated in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the justice of due, the conviction that slavery flouted divinely grounded rights, impelled Abraham Lincoln's involvement in politics, as he first explained in his Peoria speech of 1854, as well as the advocacy of Frederick Douglass and the abolitionist movement. That the Lincoln Memorial was the backdrop for Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech of 1963 is no accident, for King, too, made natural rights and divinely grounded natural law central to his quest for civil rights. Lincoln, the most Christian U.S. president in thought and words, sought to end slavery in a manner that would bring about healing and restoration and preserve unity in the nation's democracy. In contrast to other political advocates in the North, including some clergy, he interpreted slavery as the nation's common sin. And, in his second inaugural address in March 1865, interpreted the Civil War as the nation's common atonement for slavery, quote, the woe that was due, unquote. It was a punishment, though, that could reunify. Lincoln's stance towards the Confederacy met the criteria of forgiveness. He inveighed against revenge and mostly forewent retribution, provided that slaves were freed and Southern states remained in the Union. He concluded his second inaugural address by advocating mercy and care towards restoration of a common nation, with malice towards none, with charity for all, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. Unquote. Similarly, King pursued his uncompromising campaign for rights through nonviolent action that practiced love for enemies, forgiveness, and a call for a united, beloved community. Principles that exceed due complemented rights, composing the wider justice that I have been describing. Colossal historical injustices leave behind wounds, as they have in Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and Kashmir. The most central of these is what I term the standing victory of injustice, the moral fact of the injustice itself that persists in time unless redressed. Other wounds persist as well. In the case of race, the many disparities between African Americans and the large population, the larger population. The greatest of these is the gap in wealth, one's total stock of possessions, which averages $240,000 per individual. Both controlled studies of population data and experimental studies reveal large disparities between blacks and whites also in a wide range of measures, such as health profiles, the ability to attain jobs and home loans, and rates of incarceration, arrest, and wrongful conviction of serious crimes. These disparities are wounds, not simply because they consist in different levels of goods, and are not less wounds on account of the income and wealth of African Americans having grown since 1970, but rather because they result from colossal injustices. None of the wounds is healed alone by the restoration of rights through legislation and constitutional amendments. Justice also consists in governmental measures that seek to restore right relationship in the nation. Why the government? And why should citizens today act to redress injustices for which most of them are not directly responsible? Certain injustices consist of two dimensions, a collective one and an individual one. These are ones that people commit in the name of an organization. For instance, the laws and policies, action and inaction, that government officials perform in the name of a political order. While the individual's responsibility is her own and dies with her if she does not repudiate it, the collective dimension of injustice stands victorious as long as the collective itself persists. It is one who has the standing to speak for the collective entity then, who may redress past wrongs in its name. Such is the rationale for apologies that the U.S. president and other heads of state have performed for past injustices, especially intensively since 1990, that Pope John Paul II performed over 100 times with respect to over 21 episodes of misdeeds that members of the Catholic Church committed in its name across its history, and that U.S. officials might perform for the laws, policies, acts, and omissions of duty that performed and upheld slavery and racial injustice. An apology could, if carried out well, negate the standing victory of the injustice, extend acknowledgement of suffering, and strengthen civil friendship. Reparations are apologies materially fortified and achieve similar goods as apologies, as well as compensate victims and their descendants for the material damage of injustice. Like apologies, reparations have become more common in global politics in the past century, including on the part of the United States government. Reparations for racial injustices are in principle warranted, though must answer questions: who exactly would receive them, what form would they take, and in what amount? Far more rarely in global politics do heads of collectivities practice forgiveness. Lincoln did, I have argued. French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman, the lead architect of European federalism after World War II, was animated by forgiveness and reconciliation towards Germany, for which Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger remembered him in 2004. Legal scholar Roy Brooks has proposed that African Americans could practice forgiveness in response to a national apology and reparations in a national movement of reconciliation. Represented by leaders of widely respected African American civil and religious organizations, they would release fellow Americans of moral debt and commit themselves and their followers to common civic friendship. Apology, reparations, and forgiveness belong to the justice of right relationship. In the case of individuals, apology and reparations are often required by the justice of rendering due. For collectivities, I would argue, these are imperfect duties on account of their not being readily dischargeable because of their dependency on resources and political circumstances. Forgiveness, by definition, forgoes debt or what is due. All of these principles might also bring about goods that exceed the payment of moral debt, such as acknowledgement, empathy, the alleviation of psychosocial wounds, and the strengthening of national bonds. The great African-American civil rights activist, Fannie Lou Hamer of Mississippi, having been forcibly sterilized, fired from her job, beaten, and subject to the firebombing of her home in fighting for equal rights, promptly judged legalized abortion to be unjust when it became more common in the late 1960s and extended nationwide in 1973. Like slavery and racial discrimination, abortion defiled the dignity of human beings and was justified by popular choice. Hamer saw abortion as eugenics and termed its wide practice genocide, as did Jesse Jackson in the 1970s. She also campaigned for maternal health care, housing, and nutritional needs, and rooted it all in her Christian convictions. She demonstrated the justice of right relationship. The justice of rendering due means protecting the right to life for unborn persons. Enumerated in the Declaration of Independence and the UDHR, this right is a natural one, embedded in the natural law prohibition of killing innocent human beings. That a human being begins life at conception, then becoming a unitary and distinct organism, is affirmed by 96% of embryologists. Its right to life is denied mainly by the claim that it has not developed the attributes or the ability to perform the actions of a person, a claim that unavoidably negates the right to life of entire classes of persons who lack development in one way or another or are deemed less than human, the claim that augurs every atrocity. Over 64 million violations of this right have taken place in the U.S. since 1973, and some 2,800 continue to take place every day on average in the U.S. The justice that exceeds due widens and reinforces the justice that renders life its due. The principle of care, a form of mercy, is an open-ended duty to aid persons in a position of dependency. Its virtues are attention and responsiveness. Feminist theorists have taken up care in recent decades, decrying an abstract individualistic rationality of rights and contracts that pushes relationships with vulnerable and dependent people to the margins. Certain Christian feminists have adopted the principle and have enfolded the mother's tie to her unborn child into care and point to Mary, the mother of Jesus, as the exemplar of this care. Care envisions life as the subject of the relationship between mother and child, both of whom are in turn dependent upon relationships to the birth father, doctors, family members, and the culture of the wider society. Fittingly titled are women's care centers, of which nearly 3,000 exist in the United States, providing material support to pregnant women and encouraging them to bring their babies to birth with high rates of success. The care principle addresses the common poverty of women who consider abortion. About 3/4 are low income, and 8 in 10 are unmarried, and urges policies that provide financial support for birth, health care after birth, child care, pregnancy leave, help in collecting payments from birth fathers, and measures that facilitate adoption. The justice that restores relationship involves healing and forgiveness for post-abortive women, the message and work of initiatives such as Project Rachel. Mirroring the civil rights movement, justice for the unborn is advocated through nonviolence and peaceful persuasion that invites opponents into a restored community. The most potent quality of the justice of right relationship may be its holism. It restores rights that protect essential dimensions of dignity and also addresses the wide range of wounds that injustices inflict. This holism extends to the wide range of injustices, including historical ones, beyond life and race. I chose these because of their magnitude and their effects on our contemporary division. I have no optimism that this division will dissipate anytime soon, yet I'm confident that the justice of right relationship may further our unity better than a far less holistic concept of justice. Thank you.
We'll now take time for a few questions.
Thank you very much. I have a question about the extent to which there's an opposition between this biblical conception of justice that you very nicely lay out and the classical notion of justice. And I'm thinking specifically of Aristotle's understanding of general justice, in which he says that general justice includes all the virtues that order us in community with others. And there's a passage in which Aquinas actually goes so far as to say that general justice includes mercy and piety. And so through this notion, you get something more than due. And so I'm wondering, how would you bring the biblical conception of justice that you talk about into conversation with, you know, classical general justice? And is there such an opposition?
Yes, yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think Aristotle's general justice, which Aquinas also adopts in question 58 of the Secunda Secunda, of the Summa Theological Logica, also, I think that this general justice does tend towards something much like Sedek and Dikaiosune, because it means all of the individual's obligations towards others. And so this encompassing, sweeping umbrella type and I think someone makes the case that Sedek and Dikaiosune could be also be thought of as justice, because they also are about individuals' general relationship. And so to that extent, I think there's, you know, points of convergence in Aristotle. I mean, the purest conception of justice as due comes from Ulpian in the 3rd century AD. And but there are elements of, I think Plato's Republic, his notion of justice as, performing one's duty according to one's station in a broad sense, also is wide and holistic in that same way. Both Aristotle and Plato also have elements of the justice of due as well. I mean, Plato says the justice is rendering another his due in Book One, and Aristotle has many obligations that look a lot like due. So I think there is some convergence there. Now, on Aquinas, he enshrines the justice of rendering due in question 58, that, you know, Ulpian's definition. So it might look like, I guess I am disagreeing with Aquinas in that sense. But if you look at Aquinas' discussion of justice, he fills it out a lot in a way that I think closes the gap some. So piety is a part of justice because rendering to God what is everything a Christian does renders to God what is his due, is due to God, right? But with respect to others, not all obligations render another his due, although I still think Aquinas thinks that justice is rendering due. And where we see this is in question 80 in the Secunda Secunda on the potential parts of justice. So there he explicitly identifies virtues such as liberality, which is generosity, and others as ones that exceed due. And by calling them potential parts of justice, I think he's recognizing that they're related, but he doesn't want to fully say that they're justice, because he already told us that justice is only rendering another his due. So I think he acknowledges that they're related under the same umbrella in some sense, but they're not fully justice. I mean, I think the Bible differs in that it doesn't have anything called potential parts. It just sees all of the obligations as one that renders due. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, do you know of and have you studied what's going on in Rwanda? Because I myself was kind of blown away by the way they dealt with the aftermath of the genocide. I mean, they were overwhelmed by the number of perpetrators. Yeah. So they couldn't go through the kind of due completely. They had to kind of outsource it, and it involved the perpetrators admitting what they did, taking responsibility for it in front of the people against whom they perpetrated it, who then went, forgave them, and the perpetrators served time in jail. They didn't get off. But I mean, to me, that was, kind of blew my mind. But it seems like it's a lot like what you're talking about. I don't know if it's something you've looked at.
No, I think it is. I mean, like you say, after the genocide, there were some 200,000 genocidaires in jail. You couldn't try them for 200 years. And so they had a lot of these things start with very practical problems. So they decided to have these village-level courts called gachacha courts, where the perpetrator and the people in the village and the victims would all testify. And they were supposed to bring about apologies, and reconciliation was the idea that they were supposed to kind of bring the village back together. And You know, the government put up these billboards and kind of messaged it as reconciliation was the key idea. Forgiveness wasn't officially part of it, but in many cases, Christian pastors counseled people before they appeared at Gacaca to forgive, or at least held out that as an ideal. So I think it did involve a lot of that blend. But interestingly, the way it was constructed, people could also get a prison term, you know, if they're found guilty and so forth. It could be reduced if they apologized and so forth. How well it all worked is kind of a mixed bag. There were some, you know, instances of reconciliation and apology and so forth, but there were also instances of it even feeding further revenge killings. I mean, I knew a refugee from Rwanda who escaped from the Gacaca courts, and because having testified, somebody else wanted to get revenge against her for having testified and put somebody in jail. So, you know, it's these are very, very difficult dilemmas in real life.
And, it's closer to what you're talking about and how much it's not close at all to the, as a lawyer, you know, I'm yeah. for what's the do, you know, but going beyond the do, yeah. you know, it was really, I thought it was inspiring, you know, and I've participated in a couple of their events. They have them every year.
Yeah.
They commemorate what happened, and essentially it's a forgiveness. I don't remember the exact words, but so anyway.
Thank you for your very stimulating lecture. I am agree with the general perspective, but I have a lot of questions. And first of all, and it will be the only question for this evening, I'm wondering how you can identify the ancient concept of justice as iussum cuique tribuere, giving everyone his own, and the modern concept of justice as rendering each person is right,
mm-hmm.
Because there is a huge philosophical gap, difference between the two. So
yes.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think they're synonymous. I mean, the word do can be, I mean, interesting, the word do is not really literally there in the Latin, you know, definition. It's rendering to each his own, right? Sum quique. I mean, do can mean a couple of things. It can mean the strict definition, rights, or it can mean a wider definition, like what is appropriate, right? But I adopt a stricter definition for a couple reasons. One, because I think rights are important, but also because I want to distinguish what is fulfilling somebody's rights with what is going beyond rights, right? But I also think that there's, you know, kind of classical textual evidence for interpreting it as equivalent to rights. And this is where, I don't know, Father Legge is here. He's convinced us that, as he put it in the title of his piece, Thomists have rights. And he's arguing that there's a, you know, big debate among scholars of whether Thomas Aquinas affirmed the idea of rights, people having rights, or does he just simply affirm right? But I think he does affirm rights. And if you look at the passages in questions 57 and 58, the Secunda Secunda, where he defines justice, first of all, saying it's sum quique means to render each his own. Right, so that's kind of a notion that something belongs to the recipient. He also uses the term debitum, where the English uses the word due in translations of Thomas. It's often translating debitum. And again, that's the idea that there's a debt to the person, which I also think underlines that that only makes sense if that person has a right. Like if I owe somebody paying the bill for fixing my house, that, you know, that person has a right to the payment. And I think debitum means right. And there are also lots of instances where Aquinas uses the word use in very particular instances that I think can only mean right. Like, for instance, he talks about the right of parents to baptize their children. And yes, scholars have found some like 23 to 25 different specific instances. And so in my view, he did think of justice as rendering another his rights. And in the Blackfriars edition, it translates directly this way. Justice is rendering another his rights. Now, not everybody, it's use is the term in Latin. Not everybody agrees with that. Like Professor Fredoso, my colleague at Notre Dame, is coming out with a new translation, and he calls it right, not rights. But I would want to argue that Thomas have rights, as Father Legge argued.
I don't want to get messy, but with our declining Christian culture and the soup that we have regarding our laws, we seem to, and I wanted to just get your take on what the justice system in America, I completely agree with the principle that Christianity enhances a justice system.
Yeah.
But with our declining Christian culture, I think that influence is far weaker than it's ever been here. And I wanted to get your take on how you think our justice system is doing, because as a layman, I'm seeing inappropriate mercy, I'm seeing inappropriate authority, I'm seeing cruelty, I'm seeing a wide range of things that should not happen in a justice system. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get your take.
Yes. Now, I agree with your diagnosis in terms of declining Christianity and secularization, and I think it presents two big problems corresponding to the parts of my argument. One is, if there isn't a God who established a moral order that is prior to politics, it's not clear what the foundation of our natural rights are that appear in the Declaration and the Constitution and so forth. And if we don't have a basis, that's our greatest source of commonality in our country. If we don't have that, then polarization is only likely to increase. But second of all, I think Christianity has these other principles which can help us to heal wounds and after there have been many deep divisions and violence and so forth. And I think those are great resources. This is what I think Lincoln realized. On one hand, he was all about natural rights, and we've got to get those rights guaranteed. You know, he didn't compromise on those things, but he also advocated for some of these restorative kind of binding measures. So I think that the loss of Christianity, we lose both of those things. And I think it makes me more, you know, if that's true, then it makes me more pessimistic about our future. I mean, in terms of justice, yeah, you can fall off the side of the horse of being too merciful or too lenient, but you can also be on the off the side of the horse of being too harsh. And I think there's a room for finding prudential and the right balance in there within those sets of principles. And but there is a balance indeed.
Hey, Dan, I wanted to congratulate you. I mean, this is wonderful. And for bringing full circle the work in Just and Unjust Wars in 2012 to this work here today, where you're taking what you learned in the expression and experiences of justice and reconciliation in horrific experiences of war and taking it full circle. What are the lessons we can learn in societies that are not at war? And I think that's a really important contribution. And just to maybe ask you to think of a more optimistic take, the last we've heard is the decline of Christianity and rising secularization and what that means for this argument that Christianity aids justice. But recall that that's not a global phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. And Christianity is growing around the world, particularly in the global South. That's where your first book points out the many creative instances of expansion of justice when you couldn't go in the traditional trial route. And to use the Rwanda example, 85% of the Gacaca courts, the folks first went through Catholic Relief Services and the local parishes' justice and peace and reconciliation programming. So my question is, how can we learn from the Global South in being able to bring Christian virtues and values and different creative experiences of justice to the foreground?
Yes, thank you, Marianne. It was indeed in Global South context, African context in particular, that I was, and by looking at efforts around the world, many of them in the Global South, that I was kind of ultimately inspired to think about this, because they had a kind of a different paradigm for thinking about things. And as I drilled down, I became convinced that that was a different way of looking at justice. I mean, the principle of forgiveness may be the most kind of sharp difference. And after I published my book, Just and Unjust Peace, I remember I was very excited that the first reviewer was from the New Republic. And he was an editor from the kind of New York World, New York Times Book Review and so forth. And did a very good job, very fair, good job reviewing the book. But he said, this forgiveness thing is really going a stretch too far. This is likely just to be dangerous, and this is only for the rare saint and that sort of thing. And indeed, in most of the literature on transitional justice, you won't find very much about it, except for skepticism. So I thought, well, I'm going to go find out. So I got a grant, which is what scholars do, and I went over to Uganda and did a study of 640 people who had lived through conflict, and I wanted to find out, do people really forgive? And so I did find high rates of forgiveness, and they don't seem to have the same kind of block towards it that Westerners do. I'm not saying it's easy. In our focus group conversations, yes, people talked about the huge difficulties of it, but they didn't react in such a way of saying, well, that's just beyond the pale, or that's just not, can't be part of our toolkit, or what have you. No, that was a plausible thing to do, if not an easy thing to do. And I think it has to do with a different, it is a very religious population. But I also think they have a different conception of the relationship between religion and the rest of life than in the West, where we tend to make much more of a separation. So I think the Global South has been the main laboratory for this. Yeah.
Dan, thank you for a marvelous talk. You made an extremely compelling case for the compatibility and even sort of seamless synthesis in a way of classical do and biblical more than do. And you also interestingly argued that a sort of rights-oriented conception of justice is compatible with a biblical conception of justice. Yet you alluded to the many thinkers, Oliver O'Donovan, to name just one, who are skeptical of the idea that a sort of rights-based modern individualism is really compatible with either a classical conception of justice or a Christian appreciation of the common good. What's your sort of fuller response to those critics who I think are increasingly voluble these days, who don't believe that a sort of rights-oriented individualism or liberalism, whether it comes from Philadelphia or London or Amsterdam, associated with the Enlightenment, who argue that that's really not compatible with a Christian understanding of the common good, of general justice, and so on and so forth?
Yes. Now, that's a great question. I think the skeptic of rights, when they look back at history, they see rights as being part of a movement in history that broke with Christianity. So we see this both kind of more conservative, traditional scholars who say that this was part of a modernity that left Christianity behind, and then they worry that rights become very about kind of self-possession, self-definition, very individualism, contrary to social ties and real true goods and this sort of thing. So it's really about kind of the modern individual self emerging. But then there are other scholars such as John Rawls, who thinks that rights emerged with the early modern period, and this was a great thing, that Christianity needed to be left behind, that this rights are associated with tolerance and with limits on government and with things that were modern developments leaving behind the thicker politics of Christianity before that. But I think that both on historical and substantive grounds, both are wrong. I mean, one is that I think rights just go deeply in the Christian tradition, as you have shown us, and I make my argument for rights in Thomas. But going back to these early thinkers, Tertullian, Lactantius, you can make an argument that the Cappadocian fathers have the rights, talked about the rights of the poor. You could argue that they appear in Scripture. And a lot of these cases depend upon translation, but I think if you argue that the substantive meaning is there, that this can be argued. And I would also just point out the deep, deep affinity in Catholic thought. I mean, John the 23rd, just lifts up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as did John Paul II, called it an awakening of the conscience of mankind. And so historically, I think you see much of a continuity. It's not something that just arose as a break with Christianity at a certain time in history, but goes deep back within the tradition. But then substantively, I see it not as kind of selfishness or self-possession or ownership so much as being protections, entitlements based on human dignity. Human dignity being the worth of the human person, the idea that every human person is precious and contains infinite value. I mean, Pope Francis said, entitled that document, Dignitatis Infinita, that there, every person has an infinite dignity that can't be traded off. And so I think others then have a right to respect that dignity, but then recipients of that obligation have the right to claim it. Just as Jesus commanded, love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, it's certainly permissible to love oneself as, you know, standing up for one's own dignity. And now some of the Christian thinkers who reject rights, they want to say, well, we just have moral obligations. There's right, but there aren't rights. And I think it's not wrong that we have moral obligations, but we have obligations to others based on their dignity. It would be wrong to say that we have moral obligations just for the purpose of safeguarding the dignity of our own souls or the purity of our souls or our virtue. They are about that. But I have obligations to the person in front of me because that person has dignity and worth. I have an obligation, not just an obligation not to lie, but that person has a right not to be lied to because of that person's worth and because of the value of that person's the truth and that person's good. And so I think it's that notion of dignity is really the center of things. And I think that's what Catholic social thought, how it grounds rights. And I think it's the best justification of rights.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, thank you for coming. My question is how this justice should be understood, maybe not, whether or not this justice should be understood as eschatological, because the dikaiosune type of justice is what comes from Christ condescending to earth.
Yeah.
So it's principally Christian and is lived out through the church nowadays through the Holy Spirit. But we're trying to apply this to politics, like the example you gave of this Beyond You politics being like race reparations or healthcare. We're now asking via taxes, which are compulsory, to now apply the coming of the Holy Spirit to the earth. It seems like a kind of a contradiction or a bad fit. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah. So in the argument, I think that in the Bible, dikaiosune both means God's action and human actions, right? So divine dikaiosune would be God's actions in restoring the world. And this is how Paul uses dikaiosune in Romans 3:21 as God's dikaiosune is manifested in God's restoration of the world. But it's also human justice, meaning how we act towards one another. So it involves the same restoration of right relationship. Now, when it comes to how does this apply to politics? I think that the role of the Christian is to just bring both of these principles into the world, both the rights of others and the kinds of principles that involve healing and restoration within the context and boundaries of the rule of law, and I would argue the rights of liberal democracy and so forth. One of the problems that maybe you're alluding to is what happens when we live in a pluralistic environment. A Christian is trying to make these arguments to people who don't share the faith. Well, I would argue that a lot of these principles are ones that can find analogs in other religious traditions. So if you're arguing with or negotiating with or forming a coalition with somebody in another tradition, you don't ask that they, endorse the principle on the same basis as you do, but rather you try to find common ground, and oftentimes there, are the principle of hospitality or something, can be found in other traditions, and secular people might endorse it too, right? And so in the kind of practical to and fro of politics, this kind of negotiation across boundaries is important.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Philpott.
Thank you for listening to Ordain and Establish. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you'd like to learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.